Heritage organisations are in the business of telling stories, whether it's a story about their present, how they are currently conserving, protecting or archiving, or their past, there is always a tale to be told and an audience waiting eagerly to hear it. One of the most interesting ways of telling these stories is in a podcast. Presenting this podcast, I would say that, but since their arrival on the scene all the way back in 2004, podcasts have positively changed the way that we consume media. They can drive conversation, allow listeners an in-depth look into any given subject, and are designed to be listened to on the go, making them the perfect companion for any activity, whether cooking in the kitchen or walking to work. Podcasts have had a bit of an explosion over recent years, and fortunately, the heritage sector is catching on. Heritage and podcasts are actually a perfect match. With the wealth of interesting information at your fingertips, where better to tell it than in your own podcast? Setting one up is another matter, we know. But the good news is, it needn't be expensive or involve loads of head-spinning technical jargon at all. All you need is a good idea of what you'd like to talk about, a way to record either yourself or an interviewee, this can literally be through your phone, and off you go. My name is Laura Stanley, and in this podcast, we're going to talk you through how to set up your podcast on a shoestring, the tools you'll need to get started, and advice from three organisations already on their podcasting journey. Today, I'm joined by Amy Sykes, Development and Digital Engagement Officer at Bodmin Keep, Daniel Watkins, State Rooms and Guides Manager at Annick Castle, and Michael Netter, Professional Services Officer at the Institute of Historic Building Conservation. It's worth noting that this podcast is in itself produced on a shoestring too. We're recording on Zoom with the help of our own mic, so apologies if you hear any background noise. So let's start off with a quick intro to your podcast and where you started. Amy, we'll come to you first, if that's all right. Of all our guests today, your podcast, Bodmin Keep War Stories, has been up and running the longest. When did you think a podcast might be right for you?
Hi, Laura. Well, we set up our podcast back in 2019 after I'd only been in post around 9 months. And part of my job as digital engagement manager was exactly that, to extend our reach with the museum through digital channels. So a podcast seemed to be sort of one of the obvious ones, really, that I wanted to try out. And obviously, podcasts work really well with telling stories in an engaging sort of, you're right in the ear piece of your listeners. And so that's really how I got started. It was part of my job, wanted to do one, and knew we had a wealth of stories that I wanted to tell.
Brilliant. I've had a good old listen to the Bodmin Keep War Stories. There's some lovely stories in there that you've like found and talked about. It's really good to hear them. Yeah, so let's go to Michael. Tell us more about the Institute's podcast. It was for COP26, is that right?
Yeah, exactly. We really wanted to participate in COP26, and which is the UN Climate Change Conference last autumn in Glasgow. And we've been talking about it for a long time, and we had sort of looked into physical presence there. But as it got closer, it became clear how expensive it would be, how logistically challenging it would be, and how difficult it is really to get your message across. It's such an enormous conference. So we made the decision in the summer to go ahead and go digital and to explore that. So why podcast? We've been doing webinars in the past. I think we picked a podcast for a few reasons. For one, it allowed us a great accessibility to guests. So we didn't have to sort of make everybody be there at the same place at the same time. Everyone's busy. We had people across time zones. So it was really nice. We could set up the interviews at time and dates to suit the guests. So in the end, we got all the guests that we asked because it had that accessibility. The other thing, you know, there'd been almost two years of pandemic at that point, and people had switched to the sort of webinar format. And webinars are great, and we'd use them, but we just felt it had started to get a little bit stale. You know, the sort of 20-minute speak to a PowerPoint deck, a quick Q&A that never has time for enough, really, you know, enough questions or enough answers. So a podcast is really an extended Q&A, and it really gives you the time to slow down and really flesh out the issues. So we really thought that we could explore topics better that way. And then, of course, you know, you mentioned it in your intro, you know, for listeners, they can listen to it when and where they want. It's single media, so they don't have to be sitting down sort of watching at their computer. They can be out and about on their commute or exercising, wherever else. So in the end, it really was a great format, and we're really happy that we decided to go with it.
Of course, it means people can find you later as well, right? So it's ongoing. It's always there, which is great. Daniel, you've only just started on the Anik journey, right, with your podcast? How's it going?
We launched it at the beginning of 2022, but it's something that I've wanted to do in association with the castle for a number of years. We've got so many stories and so much history we can talk about. It seemed like a really good avenue of exploring that in a different way. But the technical aspects had seemed sometimes a little bit overwhelming to me. I've appeared on podcasts with friends for a number of years, and the amount of setup and microphones always made me think, if we did one at the castle, how would we do it? And it was actually the pandemic and lockdowns that brought me round to that, because suddenly our podcast was being recorded at home with whatever we had handy, and it was being done remotely, which was tricky in another way, but made me think, actually, I could do this. So coming back from the lockdowns, getting back into work, I was able to pitch a castle podcast, knowing what we'd need, knowing how I could set it up, knowing it could be done easily and accessibly. And once we had the permission, I just got going. And yeah, we're about 10 weeks in now.
That's amazing. Also, I had exactly the same experience. My co-host moved out of London, and I was like, how are we ever going to continue a podcast? And you learn, it's quick. It's amazing how quickly you learn, and also that the options are out there, I think, which actually brings us quite neatly onto the next question. What did you need to put in place to get the podcast started? In fact, we'll go to you, Daniel. What did you have to put in place?
The main things we were looking for were microphones and technical equipment. So because I had connections with people who've done other podcasts, I was able to ask around, get a few different opinions of what's the best thing to use for this, what's the good thing to use for that, what's a budget version of that. The microphone I'm using at the moment is a relatively cheap and easy to use one, but it's one I'm confident with. Buy a couple of those, get some cables to connect it to your computer, and you're pretty much set to record. It was the phase after the recording where more needed to be put in place. Knowing how to host it, knowing how to upload it, took a little bit more learning than the actual recording itself. And once I got the hang of that, we use a hosting site called Buzzsprout, which charges a little bit of money per month, but sends your podcast out to all of the major platforms, and all you need to do is upload to that one platform and it goes everywhere else. So there was a little bit of learning as we went, but having a list, like a shopping list almost, before you start means you can tick it off. You might not even need everything on that list by the end.
Brilliant. What about you, Michael? What did you get? You're doing it with interviewees all over the place, right? So how did you get that all sorted?
Yeah, I think one of the key things for us was to really get a head start on planning and to really spend a lot of time up front, putting together what your theme is going to be, you know, how deep are you going to dive into the topic, which guests would be good in that respect, what the timing will be, you know, having a marketing plan. So really spending a tremendous amount of time up front, sort of planning it through. The other thing, sort of on that same vein, once we had our guests who had agreed, really spent a lot of time sort of researching their works and if they had done research papers or presentations or other things, and really understanding sort of where they would probably be contributing to the issue. So we could come up with sort of a crib sheet of questions that I could ask them that I knew that they would have really good answers to based on their work. And it allowed for, you know, I was really just prompting them on what they already knew they had done. So we were able to get, in a pretty short period of time, most of our podcasts were about 25, 30 minutes. You got really, really great concentrated content that was really good. And it was all because of that planning.
Yeah. So Amy, how does your production work?
Yeah, I would agree with Mike on a lot of that sort of pre-planning situation. We certainly look at it in that way and plan ours in advance beforehand. But ours happens quite differently. I use an external freelancer freelance producer to create our podcast. So I work with a lady called Karen Peary, who is a freelance radio and podcast producer. She's worked for Radio 4 and she also has her own podcast, Cornwall Women. After a chance meeting with her at a networking event, I just got chatting to her, and obviously she offered what I was hoping to do. And what was so great about getting her on board right at the beginning was all of the expertise that she already had. She was able to really walk me through the process of how to go about it. She was also there with all the technical information, so, and had all the editing stuff. So it was a massive boost to have that. What she also brings is a level of professionalism to the interview style that we tend to go for with our podcasts, just because of sometimes the subject matter that we're discussing is really sensitive or quite deeply personal for some people. I just was always really aware that I wanted someone who had a really considered interview style to do it. I didn't feel like I was up to task, if you like. So having a professional interviewer was amazing, and she's been brilliant. What that also offered us was to have a consistency of style through all our episodes. So we don't do one every week. We don't have the funding to do that. But what we do, as Michael was saying, we sort of plan ahead. We know the subjects and the topics that we want to cover over the course of, say, a year, and we will plug into any project work or any funding streams that might be available to the museum throughout that period of time. And we tailor the content to fit any project work that we might have funding for, and therefore can carve out some funding towards the podcast. So Karen brings to it that the technical support, and I bring to it the sort of the museum background and knowledge. So I will line up the interview, think about the sort of the narrative arc, where we're going with the story, if you like, of the podcast. Any object in our museum that we can talk about, go in the archives, sort out all of that, all the stuff that we're going to kind of meander through it in the time of the podcast, and set up interviewees for Karen. And then she then takes it from that point, interviewing them. And then she very kindly and is great, edits the podcast down after she's done the interviews. So I feel a bit of a cop out, really, because I don't do all of the other stuff that the other guys do.
So do you have any trouble sort of getting guests or, you know, finding people that are willing to talk on the podcast?
Well, we cover or have covered, we've done 9 podcasts up till now, and they cover a range of topics, some of which are we can cover in-house in terms of the expertise. If it's about an object or a time in history that our museum covers, we can draw on our own expertise. But also we've covered topics such as LGBTQ plus service personnel. So we've had to reach out and get some firsthand experiences of that. Also, we've done one about soldiers of colour, historically, and their experiences now. So some of the subjects we need to speak to people with firsthand experience, and that's sometimes a hard part of any kind of collaboration, is finding people to have the time, want to talk on. Not everyone wants to talk on a podcast and be exposed in that way. So sometimes it's challenging, but we've been really lucky. We usually get a good response. We've had authors talk to us if they've written a book on a subject that we're discussing. Then obviously that's a really good place to go, because often they're keen to promote their book, and in that sort of area of professionalism or expertise, it's a really good place for them to do it. So yeah, we've always had really good we've been really pleased with people wanting to come on our podcast and talk to us.
Brilliant. Daniel, is yours more focused with in-house guests, so people from Alnwick Castle?
I actually found it easier to find external guests who were happy to talk about it. When I approached people who particularly have done podcasts before, they know what it's about. Whereas people we have internally within the castle tend to be a little bit more nervous about anything where you might be on a microphone or being recorded. The fact that I have full editing control and can take out anything where they feel they've said something incorrectly does help. But when we started, I made a big list of all kinds of topics and ideas I would like to cover and sent out a whole load of emails to people who have helped us with exhibitions in the past or have written books or articles that reference the castle or its collections or its history. And I just waited to see who came back, booked in some times, and we got a really good range of guests that even though they don't work at the castle, they've got a connection, they've got a story relating to it somehow. All in the meantime, I'm working on people in the offices. Once we've got some episodes out, they know understand what it's about, they understand the style we're going for, and they hopefully understand there's no pressure and they'll all sound great. We'll get there.
It definitely helps to have episodes in the background. It gives people confidence for any future. When you ask them to get involved, they know what to expect and the style of the interview. And again, the editing procedure, like you know that you have that at your fingertips, that you can reassure them that we'll look after them and we're not there to expose any mistakes or things that they didn't want to say. So I would agree, having episodes in the background to be able to refer to and show people what your expectation is really helps.
Yeah, it's one of those weird cyclical things where you need to have a podcast to convince people to make the podcast, but they won't make the podcast unless you've already made the podcast. But once you've made the podcast, you can make all the podcasts you want.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's such a learning curve. And I do think people panic when they see a microphone, but it's including myself, to be honest. But it's once you hit the stride, it's good fun. I love a good podcast. And yeah, editing is always editing's your friend, isn't it?
I think a podcast is slightly different. It's such a different format to listening to a radio or other things that you listen to. Podcasts seem so much more personal, and the conversation style really works really well on a podcast, because often people have earphones on when they're listening to a podcast, and rather than a radio that you just have on for the whole household or workplace to listen to, they're very personal. And I feel in that way you get right into people's heads in a way, and you can speak on a deeper level than on a basic radio program in some respects. So that's why I love the format of a podcast. I think that conversational style really, really works well.
Is that what you found, Michael, when you were reaching out to, so you had quite a lot of experts on your podcast. How did you have to do any persuasion to get them involved, or were they all happy to talk about their subjects?
Yeah, to be honest, they were all pretty happy with it. I think I had some of the, similar issues where there was some hesitation, but again, convincing them that you're on their side, and if they slip up or even whole, minutes of, oh, wait, I'm rambling, delete all of that. You can do it on a podcast, and it's, it's totally fine. And so gaining that trust, I think, is really important. But it's funny, I similar to what Daniel's saying, that the hardest part was the beginning and our own team and saying this is a podcast. So I did a pilot podcast just to show everybody what it would be and what it would look like to be able to go do the podcast, which is kind of funny because I had to do the whole thing for the pilot. And then once you've done that, it's all set up. So, but everyone, really liked it. And once you can kind of demonstrate that, I think it becomes a lot easier than to go on and produce the whole thing. And it may lead to further ones down the line. We'll see.
Can I ask how you edit your podcast? Like all of this is going out to everyone.
Yeah, we, Amy, I like your plan to go out to a third party. I just sort of learned that on the fly. I used a free program called Audacity, which is really good. I would say I spent at least five times as much, I spent editing five times as much as I did actually recording. So it's you cut and you cut some more and you cut some more, and you have to make sure the pitch is aligned. But it's a lot easier than doing with a video, of course, because gaps in speaking can be glued together a lot easier than gaps in video. So it's actually not difficult. It's just a bit time consuming. And I found the tools quite easy once I really dug in.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I have a Mac at home, so I use GarageBand, which comes as free standard on Macs these days. So that's a really handy piece of software. If you're using a Mac, you can edit on there. With a lot of our remote recordings, I've used a website called Zencastr, which is really easy for people to get to grips with, and it records separate audio tracks for you, which makes that editing just that little bit easier because people don't talk over each other on the same audio track. So if you need to take part of it, you can. Like Michael was saying, it takes a long time to edit. So if you are thinking of starting one, just make sure you've got the time to sit down in a quiet space with some headphones in so you can hear it the way that your audience likely will hear it, and be prepared to spend much more time getting it right than you actually did when you were recording it.
Yeah, and that whole thing about sort of quality, not quantity, and hence why I don't do the editing. As I said, we have a freelancer, Karen, who does all of that. But what's really key is really sort of getting down to the nuts and bolts of the conversation, because obviously you can go off in tangents and stuff, and just really not, sometimes you'll follow a thread and it could be really interesting, and the listener will be interested in that. It's understanding when it's not relevant to maybe what you set out to do. So that quality, not quantity, I would say is a good lesson that we've learned of just trimming it down so it's really concise. The editing is a massive part of it, hence why I just didn't feel like I had the capacity to be able to do it. But we don't do as many podcasts. We don't commit to doing one once a week or once a month. We've got two scheduled in for this year. We may get another two towards the end of the year, but certainly we sort of aim for much less quantity for us.
Yeah, another advantage that Amy has, which I found personally, is in the editing process, I've really had to get used to my own voice, which I hate listening to. But when you have to edit a podcast that you are presenting yourself, you've got to hear yourself over and over again. So I'm quite ruthless in cutting my bits. And that's why I really like the format that Michael and Amy both have, talking to guests, because the more they speak, the less I speak and the less I have to edit myself. So if you're one of those people who doesn't like their own voice, be prepared. You'll either have to get used to it or you'll have to convince a colleague to present for you.
I would also say as well, part of the joy of having a professional interviewer do ours, for all of the reasons that I said before, but also it's having a really good interview style, being able to ask an open-ended question. And I've done lots of interviews with my job, talking to people and then maybe transcribing my own interview for a blog post or whatever. But actually on a podcast, I'm not very good at asking an open-ended question. And I was really aware of that in the podcast medium, that you want to allow your responder, your interviewee to open up and discuss the point. So I didn't feel like I had those skills. It wasn't something that came naturally to me to interview in that way. So for me, I was quite happy to hand that over to somebody else. I don't know how you guys get on with that kind of open-ended interview style.
For me, it kind of depends on the guest a little bit. If, for example, on our most recent episode, I interviewed an author who had, after 20 years of research, finally brought out his book about one of the dukes and duchesses who had lived at Alnwick Castle about 250 years ago. And I was able to ask one question. I knew it was a big, broad question, but I knew that he could confidently talk for a while about that subject, and he did, and it was absolutely fascinating. Similarly, we've got one coming up about Shakespeare, and I brought in somebody I knew who is an expert on Shakespeare. And if you ask him anything about Shakespeare, he can talk as much or as little as you want him to. In other cases, it takes a few nice introductory questions, like Michael was saying, to get used to the nerves a little bit and to show that this is okay, this is a conversation, you can speak at length, I'm not testing you on anything. And by question three or four, the answers are getting longer, things are getting more natural, and you end up with something really good, even if that means you maybe take out the first couple of questions from the final edit and you start with the conversational method, you've managed to relax them into it. Other guests have no such problem.
I would also say as well that in times of COVID and the lockdowns and everyone working from home, I mean, this is just a great example of it. We're all working remotely, but able to plug in our microphones and record this podcast now. That has really opened up so many more opportunities for us to have interviewees who aren't in our locality. And then the option, I mean, it's just so much more normalized to do things over Zoom or, you know, just recording in this way. So that opened up so many more opportunities for us to be able to talk to authors who don't live in Cornwall. Just to extend that out to have more opportunity to talk to more types of people in regard to the topic that we were discussing in our podcast. So I would say COVID in a way opened up that more to us because it just familiarized people with this kind of mechanic so much more.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. You know, we got such a great slate of guests that I don't think we maybe would have had the ambition to even try to do a couple of years ago. And back to the other question on getting guests to open up, you know, I think we were quite lucky that all of our guests knew their topics so well. As far as the format, I found it helpful to the first question after the intro off the bat was always, tell me about yourself, how you got started, why you're passionate about this. And I found that if you can get people sort of talking about their own history, they could just open up really nicely on that question. And then we're at comfort to just go into the specific points.
I love presenting a podcast, not having to hear my own voice too much, but it's always, I love it. I feel like we're warming up now, guys. This is it.
It's a good example of it, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I was going to ask, how are you sharing your podcasts? What do you do once you've recorded it?
Okay, so we use Libsyn as our hosting, and then I use all social media channels to share that we've just, you know, posted there's a new episode out. I also write blog posts for our museum. So it will sort of, usually there's sort of a project or something going on in the museum, but it all sort of ties together. So it helps sort of land the content with other stuff going on, perhaps an exhibition or something else going on in the museum. So usually it all kind of ties together, and there's quite a lot of communication about the same topic area that is going out at the same time. But sharing everything that we do across social media really helps. On all the obvious channels. We also have a hosting page on our website, which has all our podcasts on it. So we can always get people to click back to our website and then maybe listen to the podcast and then maybe explore some of the other stuff that we have on our website too. So it's always a good way to get people returning or coming back to your site, develop that communication further with your listenership, really.
What about you, Michael? How did you share it on your site?
Yeah, very similar. I mean, I think we used Castos, which is a hosting site, and I think similar to what Daniel was saying a little earlier about the hosting site they use. Once you put it on there, then it can sort of automatically launch to the various other places where you might find podcasts. So we're on Spotify, we're on Amazon Music. And those are nice to just, so audiences might come across your podcast who otherwise wouldn't engage with you. We also, for the first time, we used Google Ads. So as a charity, we had a certain amount of free Google Ads. And because we're doing issues related to climate change during the COP26, it was a very topical issue, and we're able to utilize a lot of terms. So there's a lot of terms that would fly around, which weren't very well maybe known or defined things like net zero. You know, a lot of these terms in construction and with buildings and climate change. So for the average sort of casual interested searcher, they might come across our podcast that way. And it ended up, we actually did get quite a few leads through that, and all for free. So in the social media channels, just a wide variety of ways that you can both get across to your own networks, but also try to find new networks. And so that was, I guess I forgot to mention, that was one of the big reasons we did a podcast as well, is to try to find new audiences and not just our own existing networks. And we think it worked quite well.
Yeah. Our system is pretty similar to Amy's and Michael's. So the hosting site we use is Buzzsprout, which, as we've mentioned, takes you out to Apple Podcasts and Spotify, gives you an embed code so we can create a page on our website that's dedicated to the podcast feeds. Promoting it is the job of the social media channels. So the usual Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, those kinds of things. One of the advantages I found with Twitter particularly is if you have a guest, you can tag them in it. If they retweet it, then it's going to reach their audience that might not necessarily intersect with yours, but soon they will. And we're looking into having a couple of visuals to accompany the podcast, and then we can upload it onto our YouTube channel as well. So if you don't use Apple Podcasts or you don't go to Amazon Music, but you use YouTube, you can still listen to the podcast through that method as well.
Yeah, we did the same thing, Daniel. We actually, another thing, we used a software called Evidimu. I believe it's French, but it's a free video editor. And what I did is I took, I recorded the whole thing on video, and I took little snippets, so maybe 30 seconds to a minute long, and I cut those down and I used them for promotional purposes. So even though a podcast is all audio, when you're on social media, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, you know, the studies show that people engage with video a little better than they do just audio. So I did video advertisements in a way for the podcast to sort of increase the engagement and pulling in the new audiences. That was sort of a strategy.
I mean, if your style of podcast is going to be like a conversation, say between two or three people in a room, I've seen podcasts do this now to get the YouTube audiences, is that they just record them recording the podcast. So there's a visual of the recording of the podcast. And like you were saying, some people just listen to podcasts that way through YouTube. It's exactly the same recording, but you're just seeing the people with the headsets on chatting. So there's a great possibility, you know, there's potential there to cross both mediums with YouTube and the obvious podcast channels.
About being available in all the right formats, isn't it, that everyone wants, make it easy for people to listen in whichever way they prefer, I guess. I guess my final sort of question would be around sort of challenges or unexpected challenges you've come up across. Is there any piece of advice, if you could only give one piece of advice, say, to someone thinking about starting their podcast in the heritage sector, what would you say? Let's start with Michael.
Okay. One piece of advice, I guess, to me, would be to have fun with it. You know, I actually had a tremendous amount of fun recording the podcast. I got to do things that you'd never do, you know, before or after. Things like we had to commission a jingle for it. So, you know, you're listening to music and you're selecting music and just talking to all these great guests that we had and all the research and interviews you do ahead of time in the preparation. It was also different kind of than what we're used to. It was a tremendous amount of fun. And so I think you can actually really enjoy making and creating a podcast.
Having fun with it is definitely an excellent tip. My challenge / top tip is something that I've picked up only over time and have got better at, but it's something that was pointed out to me in the first podcast I was part of. If you are presenting or you're being interviewed and you stumble over your words or you can't think of a word, just restart your sentence and go again. It doesn't matter in the moment when you're recording, but you will thank yourself when you're editing.
And leave a gap, right? Because having edited podcasts, that is always the tip. leaving that between them when you restart the sentence. So then you can see where you need to snap it.
Yeah. And it might seem unnatural. It might seem obvious, but it really does help.
It does. It does. I learned it the hard way several times.
totally agree.
What about you, Amy?
I would say just really think about what you want to talk about and possibly push yourself into new areas or push the heritage organization into discussing topics or themes that maybe haven't been discussed before. With a podcast, as we've sort of discussed, it gives you a really great opportunity to go in deep with people about a topic. So you might hear new perspectives on something. And that's what I really love about the podcast forum, is that you can really delve deeply into something and find new things out and speak to a range of different people on a topic that you maybe didn't realize before. So I would say really think about your topics that you want to talk about, or how your, what your plan is with your podcast, because there's so much out there that, and people that can bring to it that you can talk and interview with. So yeah, I just think push yourself to think about the topics you could explore with it.
There's so many in the heritage sector, so many. All three are great pieces of advice. Thank you so much for talking to us about your podcast, guys. It's been really interesting. Yeah, we hope this has been an inspiring conversation for any organisation thinking about starting your own podcast. Have a lovely day. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you for having us, Laura.
You can find more information on how to embrace digital in your heritage organisation on the Digital Heritage Hub, which we will link to below in the description. We'll also link to all three podcasts mentioned today, because I think it's always good to hear some more about what's going on. And yeah, thank you so much for listening.